Motivation is energy. In this part of the training program, we look at how passion, drive, risk-taking, and commitment are all part of the same package. You might find it interesting that Jim and Peter don't spend a lot of time promoting outcome or goal motivation. They want you to concentrate on the process of whatever you're doing, on having fun. In this way, top performance will become a habit you'll enjoy exercising.
People always ask, how in the hell do you get motivated? If I'm not motivated, how do I get motivated? You get motivated with stress and then recovering from the stress with good recovery. And then you get psyched again. Then you can make waves if you've got that. What people think is that, what if you don't have any motivation? They tell you to go out. Well, you should set goals. You got to go out and set some goals. So that's what's different about this, is that if you get the... If you're absolutely down here, it means you either haven't been making enough waves or the recovery cycle of the wave is incomplete. And then all of a sudden, motivation is natural and normal. It's healthiness, vitality. It's the essence of life. It's energy at its purest form. I want to do, I want to accomplish, I want to be something. We've learned in professional sport that the single best predictor of how far an athlete will go is his or her level of drive. Drive means passion, motivation, commitment, hunger. It basically determines how much effort and work, how many obstacles, how many barriers, roadblocks, how many sacrifices an athlete will endure to achieve his or her objectives. Motivation is the energy we're talking about. It's really the essence of everything this program is all about. When I think of professional tennis players in the game today, I have to think of one person. His name is Thomas Muster. His fellow competitors call him the Miracle Man. In April of 1989, he was on a major roll. One of the hottest players on the circuit, he was closing in fast on breaking into the top five in the world. After defeating Yannick Noah in five grueling sets to reach the finals of the prestigious Lipton International Championship, his first major final round appearance, Muster felt on top of the world. In less than 2.5 hours, however, following his semifinal victory, Thomas Muster would find himself in the emergency room of Miami's Mercy Hospital facing surgery on his left knee. And the issue suddenly was not whether he would be able to play in the next day's final, but whether or not he would ever walk again. A drunk driver speeding on the wrong side of the road crashed head-on into Thomas's car as he was getting his tennis bag out of the trunk. His left knee and thigh were badly crushed from the impact, and his body was pinned under the automobile. Muster felt lucky to be alive. A medical team determined that he had suffered severe damage to two knee ligaments and was told he would have to return to Austria, his home country, for more extensive surgery and treatment. Muster had achieved his ranking of number 6 in the world just prior to his April 1989 tragic accident. By October of 1990, Thomas Miracle Man Muster had done the impossible. He again achieved a world ranking of number 6. He was simply not to be denied. No pain, no surgery, no setback, no obstacle could block his path. He got used to the pain, he said. 10 days after his final surgery, his leg still in a plastic cast, he suspended himself from a harness above the court so that no pressure was exerted on his left knee, and he started pounding balls. No excuses, no complaining, no looking back. How easy would it have been for him to say, how could a drunk on the wrong side of the road nail me? In my greatest hour as an athlete, how could I be robbed of all that prestige and all that money? My future was literally about to change in a major positive way. And then this? All the endless hours of rehabilitation, pushing, fighting, sweating, could have led to nothing for Muster. There were no guarantees. There were lots of people who thought his career was now over. He took a big chance with himself psychologically, and as a result, his motivation and his hunger were unstoppable. Risk-taking is always a central component to motivation. Mental toughness, risk-taking, and motivation, we have learned, are all part of the same package. Thomas Muster has got the package. And believe me, it was no accident. He is where he is because he made it happen. He was able to combine his passion, his purpose, and he was able to take a risk. And all motivation involves some risk-taking.
Jim and I talk often about motivation. What is it? And why don't we like to be called motivational speakers? And it's because so much trash comes out from so many people about this thing called motivation. A Thomas Muster story, a brilliant story that it is, and it also shows me an exemplar of what you can do. I had never even thought about being suspended on top of a tennis court. Maybe that would have improved my tennis too, and I didn't even break my legs. But what is this thing called motivation, and what does it have to do with Win One for the Gipper or Zig Ziglar? And one of the things that we really came to understand is that it is a combination of passion and purpose. And it's real clear to see in Thomas's story how passionate and what a purpose he had, and combining those two really makes a difference. But it's a lot deeper than that. It has a lot to do with things like diet and exercise, because it is pure energy. How can I be a motivated person if I never do any exercise and therefore I have no energy? Or I eat all the wrong food and therefore I have no energy? So actually speaking, motivation is a huge subject. And it has to do with biochemistry, it has to do with passion, it has to do with purpose. It has to do with loving what you're doing more than the outcome of why you're doing it. So that we find that motivated people are absolutely present-centered as opposed to future-centered. When I ask myself, if I can just win this point, I'll win the game, my performance suffers. And the whole point is to just live in the present. We're going to look at motivation, and we'll examine it from a number of different faces to look and see what really motivation from a peak performance, from a mentally tough point of view, would be. How do you get to that ideal performance state, high positive energy on a consistent basis? Now, if you notice from the Thomas Muster story, the motivation to come back certainly was not by fear. There was no pushing that he had to come back. Was it anger-driven? I don't believe it was. Was it driven from outcome? It couldn't have been, because he had no way to know if he'd ever play again, much less be able to win anything. So when you really analyze it, you come down to passion. This guy had a passion to play tennis. He had also the risk-taking. He didn't know, no guarantees on where he was going to end up. If you analyze the story, he just made the statement, I love what I do. I'm a tennis player. I love it. I'm going to do it. I have a purpose to do it. And anything that it takes to get me back on the court, I will accomplish. And I think what we would accomplish in this side of the tape is that we would help you understand that the mentally tough motivation we would like you to acquire by the end of this tape and practice throughout is this combination of passion and purpose.
I think it's very important that we come to a different understanding of what motivation is. For most of us, we've kind of thought of motivation as something that we can just all of a sudden make happen. That I'm not motivated, and the reason I'm not motivated is that somehow I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and I need to be setting goals. I need to sit down and set a goal, and then miraculously all of a sudden I'll get this passion that Thomas Muster had. That isn't the way it works. That isn't the way it works that I have ever seen. Sitting down and writing out a bunch of goals is not the way that you create passion in people. It needs to come from a much deeper level inside of you. First of all, motivation reflects a very deeply rooted set of psychological needs. It has to come from a very deep kind of sense of who you are as a person and what your whole psychological need state is. That's important, yes. But even at a more basic level, motivation is energy. Motivation is life. If you take out the energy component to performance, you have nothing. If you take out the energy component to life, you have nothing. And what we've come to understand in terms of stress, if you balance the cycle of energy with the cycle of recovery, you get another cycle of energy. And so what you have is motivation kind of breeds itself when you're adequately putting enough deposits in the bank after you take money or after you make a withdrawal. So the first thing is, if you can't get passion in anything, something's wrong. You need to look at the extent to which you are creating cycles of stress and balancing them properly. Secondly, you need to take a look at what are your natural passions in life. What can you get spirited about? And now let's look and project that into the future. How will the accomplishment of certain things connect to that? We must begin to put a purpose to the passion. But always realizing that when we put our passions into motion, that creates stress, and that must be balanced, perfectly, symmetrically balanced with cycles of recovery. And when that happens, our spirit will be alive, will be naturally, totally engaged, and we have a person who is passionate, and we can then put a purpose to that passion.
Albert Camus, the French existentialist, once made the statement in The Myth of Sisyphus that the first thing you should do every morning is ask yourself whether or not you should commit suicide. If you can get by that one, then have a good day. And I think what Jim is saying, and I agree with it, is motivation is really passion for life. And there are a lot of people in this country that do not have it, in fact, are not really very much alive. And it's this passion for living and this rush of doing something that's quality that even right now Tom Peters talks about. And quality, says Tom Peters, and I believe it's true, is its own reward. You don't have a rush unless you've put yourself out and taken a risk. And that's where we're failing, both with ourselves and with the kids of this society and in our own corporations, because that also implies taking a risk. You can't be a motivated person and not take risks. There is no such thing as a safe, motivated person. And I think that's one of the things that we really have to take into consideration.
This issue of getting nervous, this issue of sometimes being paralyzed by fear is going to happen even though you are very mentally tough, because you're always sticking your neck out. You're always risking where you are now in trying to better yourself and go to a new frontier, to push beyond your normal limits. And there's always the risk of not making it, of never quite reaching it, of maybe disappointing yourself or others, but that's how it happens. And so we have to look beyond ourselves. We have to have the vision to go beyond the limits we currently have with ourselves, or we stop growing. But that involves commitment, energy, and risk. And those are the cornerstones of really the mentally tough performer.
Fear was the most powerful motivating force in my high school career. And I remember a Jesuit priest in high school, junior year, teaching me algebra. I never studied so hard in my life. Fear was the total motivation. I was the first person in 24 years that flunked this person. And fear for me, and I think for a lot of people, is a terrible motivator. Why? It takes you to the high negative energy. You secrete the kinds of biochemistry that don't really allow you to accomplish what you really want to accomplish.
And in addition to that, it undermines the sense of joy. I can tell you right now from what Peter just said, he hates algebra. He'll never go out and seek willfully or on his own to learn more about algebra and to really kind of look for it as an exciting new adventure in his life. That's about as far away. Am I right or wrong,
yeah,
Peter?
It's absolutely true. And my feeling is that anyone in business who uses fear as a motivator, you're doomed. And what we now know is that the only way you make it in today's world is risk-taking. As a matter of fact, PepsiCo, it's rumored that PepsiCo's marketing department in New York, if you're not making 30% mistakes, you're liable to be called in for a very strident evaluation. Because if in today's world you're not making 30% mistakes, you're not doing anything. So it's just the opposite in their case. They're saying, go make mistakes. That's the only way we can have motivated people doing creative things. So it's just the opposite.
Eliminate
fear,
the fear of mistakes. In coaching, we see the fear drive being used all the time. And it has very unfortunate consequences. the greatest of which is it undermines the natural motivation of the players. They can get the kids to do almost anything. If you use fear as a coach, you are such a tremendously powerful person in a youngster's life, and they'll do literally anything. But every time you use fear, you begin to undermine that precious fabric of commitment, because the fear makes it no fun. And even in our own lives, if we're driven out of fear of failure, it won't last, because that arena is just too painful.
The other thing that's important about that is that fear is a future motivation. You cannot live in the present when you're motivated through fear. Fear is an outcome process. And when you think about what might happen, that you might not make it, and that fear is that motivator, you cease living in the present. And we know that our best competitors live in the present moment, enjoying the process. Fear takes you out of the process and totally into the outcome.
In athletics, we're very careful to make a distinction between outcome goals and performance goals. We find that there are certain kinds of goals that provide a better, more consistent, and a more positive kind of motivational force than others. We find that a lot of people get stuck, and they set goals which are very, very outcome-oriented. They're thinking about, I got to get this amount of money, I've got to achieve this particular objective by thus and thus a date. And we've kind of been conditioned in the literature of motivation to make that happen. And there is value in that. But we're finding from a performance perspective that in terms of providing the atmosphere of least pressure to give you the greatest sense of realizing, the greatest opportunity for realizing your ideal performance state, you really need to enjoy the process. You really need to get into the performance itself and kind of get into how much fun it is just being here doing what I'm doing, as opposed to always postponing your happiness until someday I achieve this incredible goal, then I'm going to be happy. When I achieve my top 10 in the world ranking, I'm finally going to be happy. It doesn't happen that way. You achieve the top 10 ranking in the world and you're still not happy. What you really need to do is to find your sense of fulfillment and accomplishment in doing what you're doing the very best you can. And whatever happens, happens. And if you end up number 10 in the world, that's fantastic. If you end up number 1, that's even better. But if you end up number 590, if you enjoyed the process and really, really were fulfilled and fulfilled a lot of your own personal passions in that process, you were still a great success. So it's important that you look at goals which kind of set the stage for getting into the process. In tennis, a good example would be, I'm going to approach the net more often, or maybe at least 5 times in the match. I'm going to come to the net more as a kind of beginning kind of performance goal. And it didn't say I had to win the points, didn't say I had to be brilliant, I had to make the volley, I had to look great. None of that. It just simply means that I had, and I can do that. It's under my control. The difference between a performance goal and an outcome goal is that performance goals are under your control. Another example of a performance goal would be to focus on effort. I'm going to give the very best effort that I possibly can. I can control that. That's controllable. It takes the pressure off of me. I can be a success with myself if at the end of this contest, I can literally say I gave the best effort I have. Another thing that's under my control is my attitude, that I will have a great attitude while I'm on the job. Today, when I'm no complaining, no looking at the boss and giving weird faces, I'm going to accept the cards that have been dealt to me today. I'm going to deal with them the best I can. I'm going to have a great attitude. Now, I can, in fact, control that. That's a performance goal. And I can realize a lot of things in that process, including having fun more consistently. And it takes the pressure away from me so I can really perform in a pressure-free climate, exactly what the ideal performance state conditions call for. So I think it's important that we realize goals are important. Yes, you do need to have performance goals. You do need to have outcome goals. You need to set long-term, short-term, intermediate goals that keep you focused and on track and making you feel good, but the combination of those two creates the best climate. And in terms of doing the best job you can right here and now for this task, performance goals are much more important than outcome goals.
Peter now talks about injecting passion and fun back into endeavors that might seem like drudgery. It's called creating a play frame. And all it requires is a little creativity and a desire to make the absolute best of whatever life hands you.
You know, Warren Bennis, in his book on leaders, talks about one of the distinguishing characteristics is they love what they do. And the other distinguishing, one of the other distinguishing characteristics is they don't dwell on their shortcomings. They just pay attention to what they're good at. They hire somebody else to go do their shortcomings. But they live in the present moment. Instead of saying, why can't I be more this way or that way, they dive in with what they have in the present moment, and they literally love it. If one question we could ask, we could have you ask yourself, it would be, do I really love what I'm doing? And if I don't, is there a way I could create a play frame around what I'm doing so that I can build some passion back in? I believe marriages and jobs are not just things you walk away from, but they're things that you really question about. Can I build back the passion and the joy that I don't find there anymore? But if you can't, there's no way that you'll ever be the best you can be, because you can't be a motivated person if you don't love what you're doing.
And it's real true. The dictum, no passion, no greatness, is true. Greatness comes out of passion. And as we said earlier in this tape series, the best single predictor of how far you're going to go in a job, in athletics, in anything in life, is going to be your level of passion, your level of drive. And so we got to keep that healthy. That's the essence of achievement. You got to keep your drive healthy. You got to preserve your drive. So when you're looking at a gas gauge in an automobile, you're always real careful to make sure you got a tank that's at least on half or whatever, particularly if you want to go the distance. You're always looking to make sure you got fuel in there. Well, in a real sense, motivation is the fuel. You want to keep an eye on that tank. When it gets low, you got to go refill it. So we want to fuel the tank, and we want to fuel it with the highest octane fuel that we can. We're driving super Ferraris, all of us, very complex Ferraris. And just like a Ferrari that is running on very poor octane fuel, we're going to get bad acceleration, poor achievement, if we don't have the purest form. And the purest form of energy comes from high positive emotion, from the positive emotions. And we'll see in the diet chapter how what we eat augments that fuel in a tremendously positive way in the form of glucose. But it's real important for us to keep an eye on our motivational tank. That's the best single indicator of how healthy things are inside of us. And as part of this program, check your passion, check your motivation, check your sense of energy.
When I backed off and rediscovered my passion, I found out that it wasn't real estate, so I left. I mean, Jim and I are both people who really took what we talk about seriously. We both left different kinds of things to move into what people were kind of afraid of. I mean, when Jim became a sports psychologist, it was a brand new territory. Here he was very safe as a clinical psychologist, the head of one of the largest mental health centers in the state of Colorado. And he said, no, my passion is to discover why people perform well, why certain athletes perform well and others don't. I was doing real estate, and the play frames around it, I found out, were all taking me away from real estate, starting a symphony run, doing this and that. And so I decided that my passion really wasn't real estate. So in fact, one of the ways that you can understand motivation is to back off what you're doing, look at it, either leave it because it really isn't and has nothing to do with your passion, or rediscover it in a brand new way. And you can do that, and a lot of people do. I can go back with a renewed sense of effort if I can rediscover it, if I can find my passion in it. And one of the ways we can do that is the other thing that we talk about a lot, and that is the creation of a play frame. We were dealing with a large corporation, a Fortune 200 corporation called CooperVision, and the person that was in charge with quality control, and literally what that meant was she organized a group of people who handled all the complaints from ophthalmologists, and literally was fed up with her job. she was thinking she wasn't really accomplishing anything. All she was doing each day is helping these people who would come to her after the 10th call and say, I can't take this anymore. I've had 10 nasty calls. I can't take it. So what we helped her accomplish was to take this whole problem of client relationships and recast it in a new way. And the point was, instead of just trying to make it through, to try and help her create a play frame within her particular department whereby people would enjoy their jobs. If they did, then she got her meaning for being there again. So she did a variety of things. One included every 11th phone call, they would get a joke or an aphorism at them, and they never knew when it was coming. And it's like laughing in church. When you laugh in church, everybody laughs because it's a place where you don't expect it. It literally turned the place upside down. There was fruit served all day long. They had more and better breaks, and she got an aerobics instructor twice a week. And what happened was she now put the passion back in her job because she said to herself, I literally can help this company, this group of people, go forward. I have a meaning. So the very same job a year later, she's got a promotion, she has more money, and she loves what she does. That is creating a play frame. And we can do it if we're creative enough, and that comes back to the motivation. Am I motivated to give it a whirl, take a risk, try some things? If the risk fails, I'm out of there, which is all right, because I'm not happy there anyway. If the risk makes it, I'm there and I love it. We'd like to leave you with a couple of questions for you to think about. And I think if you can answer yes to all these questions, then you're on your road to being mentally tough. One is, do you have passion? If you have passion, you're in good shape. That's a good start. If you don't have passion, you might examine this whole realm of work-rest balance. Have you been withdrawing more from the bank in terms of energy than you've been putting in? Have your cycles of stress been overtaking the cycles of relaxation? Number two, if you do have passion, where is it? Is it in your job? Is it in your marriage? Do you have a purpose for your passion? Thirdly, and a real key question is, do you love the process more than the outcome? And lastly, can you make it fun? Is it fun now, or can you make it fun? If you cannot put fun into what you're doing, you're going to have a problem. If you can make it fun and you're not doing it simply because you haven't paid attention to it, then we would suggest that you begin to put fun into it. That's your job, is to make what you're doing fun.
We tend to think of fun as something that just automatically happens or doesn't happen. We absolutely have a great deal of control over the state of fun, over this play frame arena, and we need to take responsibility for that as well, that we can create a state of fun by simply making that a high priority wherever we wish to perform.